listen, listen, listen. God is speaking to us.
Kairos Milwaukee United Church of Christ presents Life Together, Vulnerability. The sermon by the Reverend Gene Randall Bodman, presented on Sunday, May 29th, 2016.
May the Lord be in my words and in all of our hearts. We have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. Today we continue our encounter with Paul's second letter to the church that he had previously founded in Corinth. Between his earlier letters and a promised follow-up visit, the church had entertained other teachers who used spiritual gifts, miraculous healings, and speaking in tongues to prove that they were the true apostles. And then these powerful interlopers went about preaching a message that flew in the face of Paul's teaching, claiming that before the God-fearing Gentiles and all the other Gentiles, those not yet acquainted with Judaism, before they could become Christians, they must first follow all the laws of Judaism, including becoming circumcised and following the dietary restrictions. Now, that would include not eating meat that had been sacrificed to idols. And just for some context, in that world, the gods of ancient Rome were not exclusive. People often worshipped at many shrines or temples, more than one god, as long as they gave their primary obedience to the emperor at Rome, everything else was fine. Temples held banquet halls, and they were important in the civic life. Guilds met there, families met there for weddings and funerals. So to cut oneself off from eating meat that had been sacrificed to these idols would be to cut oneself off from community. This was a large thing that was being asked, and Paul wanted to say, no, no, don't push people there. Welcome them in. They don't need to follow all of that. So this was part of the fight that was going on between Paul and these other apostles. So as I mentioned last week, 2 Corinthians is made up of a combination of passages from several separate letters. In today's reading, Paul's open conflict with the community seems to have resolved. But still, Paul is reminding the Corinthians of the work and suffering he has undergone on their behalf. And in contrast to the wonder-working Judaizers who have interfered, Paul's authority rests not in his power and dazzling acts, but in his very weakness. God makes use of Paul's weakness to convey the gospel. And just as an aside, later in the letter, Paul hastens to assure us that he could do those wonders if he wanted to. But he doesn't, because it's not about him. Well, it's a little bit about him, because after all, God did choose him as an apostle, and he is only human. He wants to be both humble and holy and heard. And as we have evidence around us in the political sphere, people tend to listen to those that seem powerful. And it is this tension between weakness and power, brokenness and authenticity, that I want us to consider today. We have this treasure in clay jars. Paul was a man who was painfully aware of his limitations and his vulnerabilities. If ever there was a clay jar holding immeasurable treasure, it was Paul. After all, he'd switched religions. He'd served time in jail. He was notorious on the circuit as a troublemaker. He was bothered by some emotional or physical malady, his thorn in the flesh, as he called it. It seemed to preoccupy his thoughts. Perhaps as a result, he was more than a little neurotic. Many people have thought so. I'm not sure if, judged by appearance or reputation, he would have passed muster as a candidate for ordination in the UCC. But there were even more serious problems than appearances. With Paul, there was the issue of character. He started out as something of what we might call a right-wing religious zealot. He was a nut job. He describes his earlier self in a fairly alarming way, not just a devout Pharisee at odds with the proclamation of the early church, but as a zealot bent on persecuting and killing Christians. In the book of Acts, we have that awful account of the death of the first of the martyrs, Stephen. Stephen was stoned to death, with Paul consenting, standing by, holding the coats of those doing the murdering. It was an ugly death and an ugly business all around. Later in the same chapter, we read about Paul ravaging the church, entering house after house and dragging men and women out and taking them to prison. His rage at these first disciples was so great that the author of Acts describes it as breathing threats and murder against them. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogue at Damascus, so that if he found any who belonged to the way, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. He asked for special permission to be able to persecute other people. We also know about Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus. On his way to do harm, when God meant to do good, God appeared to him and said, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" He was blind and mute for 3 days, and the rest, as they say, is history. Paul was a clay jar in which a priceless treasure was entrusted. Now, a clay jar is a humble thing. It's everyday. It's useful without being extravagantly valuable, but it's made to hold water, the stuff of life. It's easily broken. And in Paul's understanding, it is made to hold the light of the gospel. And maybe that can describe every one of us: humble, fragile, containing great treasure. Nadia Boltz-Weber talks about this experience and our tendency to not want to see the broken bits, the fragile parts, the part that's easily smashed. She says, and I'm quoting her at length here, "I feel like so much of religion and spirituality are plans for buffing ourselves up, shining our little rough edges off, and making ourselves good again, or making ourselves worthy, or making ourselves sort of calm and spiritual. And yet, I think that those jagged edges of our humanity are the places that God grabs hold of us. And we're trying to constantly have our own program for cleaning that stuff up. But her experience is that God grabs hold of her just where she is most jagged and keeps saving her from herself. This is a kind of spirituality in which God's mercy washes over her when she feels most starkly unworthy, when she has dug for herself a pit from her own behavior." I don't know if any of you have ever had experiences like that, where you engage in a cycle of behavior that you know is not helping you. Like, for instance, my engaging in snacking late at night on Oreos and then not exercising. Over and over, I do the same behavior. And over, I tell myself, this behavior is not helping me. I'm not feeling well. I'm not thinking well. I'm not praying well. Where are the Oreos? The same behavior. And it's when we're in those ruts that we have dug for ourselves that God's mercy washes over us. And she says, "I don't know why I can't just manage to avoid digging the graves in the first place, but it hasn't happened yet." The Oreo part, that was me, not Nadia. She's got her own stuff. She goes on to point out that in her most recent book, Accidental Saints, she includes a lot of stories about messing it up. Lots of stories about getting stuff wrong. Having God alive in us does not mean that we get things right all the time. It means that when we get things wrong, that is not what defines us. That is not the final word. But that is something that we do a lot, isn't it? We present our best selves to the world, our polished up selves. And then we start thinking that that other stuff, our flaws and wounds, our petty meannesses, our insecurity or anger, our selfishness, we think of those not just as flaws, but as dangerous truths, which if somehow they got out, would destroy us. Think about it. Is there something that you say to yourself, if other people knew this about me, I would be lost. They could not love me. They wouldn't want to be around me. Now, I'm not suggesting that we run around telling every person we meet every single unlovely truth about ourselves and every detail of every mistake we've ever made. I'm just thinking it would be good to start by telling ourselves the truth, and maybe a trusted friend or two, and then perhaps some others who we think it might help to hear that about us. While I was a graduate student at the University of Virginia, my husband David served a little tiny church in the Shenandoah Valley. Most of our congregation were dairy farmers, and their day-to-day workwear was overalls or coveralls and very dirty work boots. But on Sunday, these folks dressed up. They dressed for church. Three-piece suits, winter, summer, or fall, a tie with a tie pin, shined-up shoes. And the best compliment you could give a man in that culture was, "Yep, he cleans up real good." Now, I don't want to mock that tradition. Not at all. These good people wanted to honor God and each other by dressing for their celebration of church. There was genuine joy in their church styling. But too often, it seems to me, we take that impulse to dress up and we change it to mean cover up. As if we should cover up from ourselves and from other people, and as if we could cover up from God the complexity and wholeness of who we are. When I joined the church that David served in Boulder, this is when I was teaching part-time there, I went to the new members class, just like, even though I was married to one of the clergy, I went to the new members class. It was fun. And we got to share our spiritual autobiographies. We talked about what brought us to that place, where we found ourselves, our life experiences, families, the faith traditions and communities we'd been part of. And a woman whom I will call Sandra, though that is not her name, shared her story of drug addiction and dropping out of high school, years of rehab and low-wage jobs, followed by relapses, joblessness, and homelessness. Finally, 5 years earlier, she had gotten sober. She got her GED, she got some additional training, and she had a good job as a welder. She was proud that she had survived and was thriving, and we were proud and happy for her. And she confessed to us that one of the things that was so surprisingly sweet to her about joining our congregation was that it was a church that had a lot of what she called fancy people in it. Doctors and lawyers, university professors, artists, teachers, musicians. And now, because she was clean and sober, housed and employed, she felt like the fancy people could accept her. She was so honored. Well, on the day that we all joined the church, the senior pastor, remember, not my husband, he was the associate, the senior pastor took his notes from the new member class and he introduced us all to the congregation one by one with some basic biographical details. When he came to Sandra, he talked about her being a lifelong Coloradan and a welder. And then, without skipping a beat, he said, "And she's struggled with drugs and alcohol for years, and she's been on the wagon for 5 years. I felt my blood run cold. I was horrified for her. He had taken her most closely held secret and shared it with 400 strangers, people whose good opinion this vulnerable woman craved. I sat through the rest of the service sort of numbly stunned. I couldn't believe that the pastor had been so stupid and so mean. But after the service, this other thing happened. The moment the service ended, I noticed that Sandra was surrounded by a small group of people, fancy people, doctors and lawyers and professors, and they were hugging her and congratulating her on her 5 years of sobriety and sharing how long it had been for them. Good for you. I've got 3 years. You're an inspiration to me. I've got only 6 months. I have 7 years. Welcome to First Congregational. I'm so glad you're here." Parker Palmer, a Quaker and the founder of the Center for Courage Renewal, discusses this tendency we have to hide our broken bits and to protect our vulnerable places. He often quotes Thomas Merton, "There is in all things a hidden wholeness." Afraid that our inner light will be extinguished or our inner darkness exposed, we hide our true selves from each other. In the process, we become separate from our own souls. We end up living divided lives, so far removed from the truth we hold within that we cannot know the integrity that comes from being what we truly are. This dividedness can lead us to withhold our energy and our creativity. We're spending that energy and creativity protecting ourselves. We experience this incongruity between our own inner and outer selves, and we perceive that same incongruity in others. It can undermine our morale, our relationships, and our capacity to do good work. During a commencement address, Parker Palmer offered the graduates an antidote to this tendency to split ourselves. He was addressing the students of Naropa, a Buddhist school in Colorado. And he said to them, "Take everything that's bright and beautiful in you and introduce it to the shadow side of yourself. Let your altruism meet your egotism. Let your generosity meet your greed. Let your joy meet your grief. Everyone has a shadow, even Buddhists, even Quakers, and I would add, even progressive Christians like the UCC. Even high-minded people like us, maybe especially high-minded people like us. But when we are able to say, I am all of the above, my shadow as well as my light, the shadow's power is put in service of the good. Wholeness is the goal, but wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of your life. It turns out your vulnerability is your treasure. And it is when we allow cracks and fissures in our facades that the light gets in and the light gets back out. When we see and own our flaws, we can see them as avenues of God's mercy and forgiveness, and opportunities to grow into greater compassion for others who struggle with the same stuff. When we bring our entire selves to our life together as a church, we become for each other conduits of the grace of God. When I bring my edginess, when someone else brings their anxiety, and another their impatience, and someone else their neediness, and when each of us is welcomed, we become free and empowered to do the work of love and justice in the world. Then our clay jars hold the light of God's love and the water of life, and we drink deeply and are renewed.